Okay, I hope to welcome everybody. I hope you're enjoying yourselves, and the exciting time that we find ourselves in is a time that we can imagine that we've never ever heard of before. But the truth is that there are always historical precedents, and when we as Jews look for historical precedents in our lives, often we find a tremendous amount of strength within those historical precedents. It sort of gives us a certain anchoring and a certain direction that we can find ourselves in as we try to handle what we think are uncharted waters. Well, in the last couple of days, I found that there have been a number of Jewish personalities who've also had to serve as leaders during different periods of pandemics and epidemics that existed in Jewish history. And looking how our Jewish leaders of those times handled those situations has been a source of inspiration for me thus far. And so I begin our series called Profiles in the Pandemic with the understanding that we're going to look at some of the different personalities who had to handle situations that were tough just like ours, and hopefully we'll take the chance to gain and grow from it as well. So tonight I really want to present and review a certain episode involving one of the greats of the 1800s. I refer, of course, to the great Rav of Posen, Rabbi Akiva Eiger. And in particular, I want to raise the curtain on the story of the great cholera epidemic that began in 1822 in India, but made its way all the way over to the Prussian-Hungarian border in 1831. I think, though, before we begin our understanding of how Rabbi Akiva Eiger handled the situation, I think we first have to understand who exactly is Rabbi Akiva Eiger. In any yeshiva-based medrash, if you walk into the yeshiva-based medrash and you try to study and ask anyone in the base medrash, who is Rabbi Akiva Eiger? I guarantee you the first thing you hear is, "Whoa, Rabbi Akiva Eiger." To be able to think through and think like Rabbi Akiva Eiger, when a student is able to be mechavein to come up with a question that Rabbi Akiva Eiger asks, then all of a sudden the student feels that that's a sense of accomplishment. The name Rabbi Akiva Eiger in the Torah world, in the Gemara learning world, in the Shulchan Aruch giving world, in the Mishnayos giving world, the name Rabbi Akiva Eiger is synonymous with brilliance. When Rabbi Akiva Eiger had a difficulty with a particular issue on a page of Mishnah or Gemara or Halacha, then that was a real issue. His Gilyone Hashas, his comments in the glosses on the side of the page of the Gemara, are so busy and fruitful that he doesn't write in commentary form. He merely turns around and makes references. He will say to you, "Look here, look here," leaving the thinker to try to figure out just what was Rabbi Akiva Eiger's question about. His responsa in the Shalos Tshuvos Rabbi Akiva Eiger and in the Drush V'Chiddush are fascinating, and some of the strongest ideas in halacha of the modern period are brought up by Rabbi Akiva Eiger. So in the Torah world, Rabbi Akiva Eiger was a scholar of the highest rate. But who was he? And so I think in order for us to be able to see who he was as a person, not just as a brain with feet, I think we need to first understand who he was. The first thing I think you need to understand is his name was not Rabbi Akiva Eiger, which is kind of wild, because I think most people who study anything that Rabbi Akiva Eiger ever wrote all call him Rabbi Akiva Eiger. But if you study his writings, you'll discover that whenever he signed Akiva Ginz. Where did Akiva Ginz come from, and how does he become Akiva Eiger? So in 1761, Rabbi Akiva Eiger was born in Eisenstadt, Hungary. He dies in 1837 in Posen, where he served as Rav, which is on the Western Prussian border. And it's important for us to realize that Rabbi Akiva Eiger was the son of Moshe Ginz and Gitala Eiger. His mother was identified as a tzaddikas and a lamdin. Not any lamdin. They write about her that she knew how to learn as good as a man, which is pretty incredible. In those days, women were not particularly identified as scholars of Gemara and whatnot. And Gitala Eiger was identified as a unique woman insofar as her intellectual prowess was considered rather strong. Now, throughout his young life, during the first number of years of his life, Rabbi Akiva Eiger was identified as a spiritual prodigy. He was identified as somebody who was quite a strong young man, but he physically was rather weak. His family chose to go with the Eiger name, as many families did. Families that had came from two sides, and one of the two sides was better identified than the other. Then, for the sake of recognition, particularly for Shidduchim, but often for other things as well, they would use the stronger name. I know that, for instance, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, the Rav Cook that we're all familiar with, had a nephew whose name was Raphael. Raphael was not Raphael Cook. He married into Rav Cook's family. However, since Rav Cook's family was a very famous family, so he took on the name Raphael Cook. So Harav Raphael Cook was not Harav Raphael Cook. His wife was Rebbetzin Cook, and in honor of her family and to help with the identification, they took on that name. And thus Rabbi Akiva Eiger did the same thing. Outwardly and in terms of public public documentation, he was known as Rabbi Akiva Eiger. But when he was the individual, he always signs his name Akiva Ginz. In his Chalos and Shuvos, he signs his names Akiva Ginz. In his Mechtavim, in his letters, he signs Akiva Ginz, because that is indeed his name. He marries his first wife at 20 years old. His wife's name was Glickel. She came from a town called Lisa, which was a well-known town. Prior to turning 20, he had been raised primarily at home. And his mother let him leave to go to the Breslov Yeshiva when he was 12 years old. So once he gets to the ripe old age of 12, Rabbi Akiva Eiger is ready at that point in time to go to the Yeshiva Breslau. And while he was there, he became known as quite the prodigy. He marries his wife, Glickel. His father-in-law was a wealthy person in the town of Lisa, and to be quite honest, considered his future son-in-law quite the treasure. And so he brings his son-in-law to Lisa. He buys the young couple a very large home. He arranges it so that Rabbi Akiva Eiger could spend all of his day's learning. And for 8 years, without any interruption, Rabbi Akiva Eiger sits in Lisa learning Torah. In the year 1790, 8 years later, Rabbi Akiva Eiger's father-in-law drops dead. And 3 months afterwards, a fire destroyed his home, that is to say, the father-in-law's home, and also the yeshiva he had built for Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Now, without any means to be able to live financially, the family was ruined at that point. Rabbi Akiva Eiger realizes that he needs to go ahead and take on a job. And so what does he do? He moves to his first rabbinate. He takes on his first rabbinate in a town called Marcus Friedland, which was in Western Prussia. And Rabbi Akiva Eiger got a job there. The contract wasn't great. And while he's there on the contract, he works for 24 years. And he was the all-doing rabbi. He was the director of the tzedakah. He made sure to get involved with the widows and the orphans. He's taking care of everybody. And for 24 years, he's taking on the entire system. He works until he gets to the point where, as he wrote to the community, he couldn't manage to keep the job because his salary in Marcus Friedland, which the people thought he was just supplementing with his dowry, having come from a wealthy background, well, he realizes his salary is not even covering two-thirds of his expenses, and yet he's working 600% for a 100% job. So he decides he has to leave Marcus Friedland, and he decides the community can't afford him, so he wants a different job. So he actually decides he doesn't want to make money off learning Torah, and he prefers to be a night watchman or a shamus. In fact, a job opportunity came out for the community that was looking for a bathhouse manager. Rabbi Akiva Eiger literally, from his seat in the rabbinate, applied for the job as the bathhouse attendant. Of course, that was immediately rejected by the community at large. Anyhow, his wife, Glickel, died 3 months after the wedding of their first daughter in 1796. And so Rabbi Akiva Eiger describes the fact that he was broken. He was broken at that point in time, and he didn't want to continue. So a number of years later, he gets ready to go ahead and marry off a daughter. And his daughter marries, and his daughter's husband dies, leaving him with two grandchildren and a daughter to support, in addition to the rest of the family that he had had at that point in time. I believe the number had gotten as high as, at that point, four children, or maybe six children. And so Rabbi Vega realizes he has to do something to find a shidduch for his widowed daughter. And so he decides to write to all the rabbis of the nearby communities, including the Rav of Pressburg, who is a well-recognized, world-renowned authority, Rabbi Moshe Schreiber, the author of the famous work, The Chasam Sofer. And Rabbi Kivega writes to the Chasam Sofer, and he tells the Chasam Sofer as follows. He says, listen, do you know a certain widower who might be appropriate for my daughter? So moved by the letter, the Chasam Sofer says, hey, I know somebody who'd be perfect. How about me? Chasam Sofer had lost his first wife at that point in time, and he thought that moving into the Ginz/Eger family was precisely what he was looking for. And so the two great men, the two giants of their generation, who were about 3 years apart, or Kib Eger being 3 years older than the Chasam Sofer, they decide to get together, meet with one another, and see if the shidduch can be worked out. At the time of the great meeting and the decision being reached that they were going to marry Rabbi Kiva Eger's daughter to the Chasam Sofer directly, both people began to cry at the Tanayim. They asked the Chasam Sofer, they asked Rabbi Kiva Eger why he was crying, and he said, well, the Gemara says in Sachem that a person has a responsibility to go ahead and marry a Bas Talmud Chacham. And I'm crying because I think Rabbi Moshe Schreiber can do much better, and he thinks that he's marrying into a family of Talmidei Chachamim, but what he doesn't realize is he's marrying into me, and I'm just not worthy for the title. And then they look over the side, and they see that the Chasam Sofer is crying his eyes out as well. And he says the end of the Gemara that Rabbi Kiva Eger is talking about also says that a person, it's also for a person to marry his daughter to an Amaretz. And I'm so embarrassed because one day my illustrious future father will realize that I'm really just a bum. The Chasam Sofer was not a bum, and Rabbi Kiva Eger was not a bum. Everybody was great, but the humility between the two men was fantastic. During this time, Rabbi Kiva Eger takes the time to begin writing many of his quality halachic works. In 1812, the Chasam Sofer decides it's not worthy for a man of the stature of Rabbi Kiva Eger to be stuck where he is. And so he decides to step in and intervene, helping Rabbi Kiva Eger get the job in the city of Posen, which was at that time considered a respectable shtadt, a respectable place to live. Rabbi Kiva Eger was 51 at the time, not exactly what you call a spry young rabbi. And at the time that he was selected to be the rabbi, there was a very large minority faction in the community that was opposed to him getting the title of Rav, arguing that Rabbi Kiva Eger was too old-fashioned for the modern times. On the other hand, there was a strong faction that was very pro having a Gadol Hador be the rabbi in the community opposing. This causes a major amount of arguing back and forth, and a number of different people got involved in order to try to save the tie. And so in the end, it was the third of the great triumvirate of Gedolim living in that area at that time, Rabbi Yaakov Loberbaum, who was the author of the famous Nesivos HaMishpat, he came in and he argued and stepped in and brokered a deal, which was resolved in 1850. With a glowing contract, the Ksav Rabbanus, that was really befitting somebody of the stature of Rabbi Kiva Eger. This is some of the background of the great man who had many trials and tribulations in his life up until 1815, who had finally established himself as a full Rav within the city of Posen, similar to the way he had set himself up in the city of Marcus Friedland. And sure enough, life continues within the town of Posen, with Rabbi Kiva Eger actively involved in so many different things. There is actually a diary that describes the day of Rabbi Kiva Eger as he was a Rav in Posen. And it's literally fascinating how the man got up at 5 o'clock in the morning every day and prepared for a day of learning, of teaching Mishnayos. His commentary on the Mishnah was absolutely outstanding. how we would study Tanakh for 2 hours every morning from 10 to 12. And during that time where he was studying Tanakh, although unfortunately his commentary on Tanakh is on the whole lost to us, how we would spend hours in the study of Torah, and how in the afternoon he would take care of the needs of the community, going back to his farm at night and stopping at 10 o'clock every night to grab a couple of moments of shara before starting out all over again to be able to take care of his community. And this is how the Rabbi Akiva Eiger proceeds until we open up the curtain once again in 1831. As I mentioned at the start of the shiur, in 1831, an epidemic that had started in India in the late 1820s finally reached the Russian-Prussian border. And Rabbi Akiva Eiger finds himself and the community around him towards the end of the summer facing a particular pandemic. A week before Rosh Hashanah, on Beis LeParshas Nitzavim, Rabbi Akiva Eiger finds the following situation in his hands. And of course, in the sources in front of us, which if you're following along on the screen, we can find both in translation from my dear friend, Rabbi Mordechai Torchiner, the Rosh Kollel of the Kollel Mitzion in Toronto, in English, after I prepared the shiur, he sent this to me, or more famously, in one of the more modern works of and writings of Chidushei Rabbi Akiva Eiger al Hashas, the Nedarim Daf Lamed Tes, where issues of Bikur Cholim are discussed. And in that source material, which Chidushei Rabbi Akiva Eiger is really just a compilation of Rabbi Akiva Eiger's thoughts all around his writings applied on the page to the Gemara. And here within, we read a certain letter that is published from Rabbi Akiva Eiger a week before Rosh Hashanah. And he turns around and he says, look, we have a certain epidemic. The doctors of the time had assumed that the reason why the cholera epidemic had been infecting the community was primarily for three reasons. Reason number one, he believed, was the doctors of the time believed, was because people were too close to one another and they were infecting one another, which of course is not a great chiddush to us. After all, isn't that what they're telling us right now as well? If we're too close to each other, infection tends to spread. And then in addition to that situation, there was a belief that something about the tallow candles was affecting the people. And thirdly, people who fasted through the first half of the day and only ate later in the day tended to get sick as well with the same cholera. So facing these three medical understandings as to what was causing the cholera epidemic to spread, Rabbi Akiva Eiger wrote a letter, which can be found in Mechtavei Rabbi Akiva Eiger 146, or in this source material, and it translates as follows. Rabbi Akiva Eiger begins by noting that in my view it's true that that gathering in a small space is inappropriate, but it's possible to daven in small groups, very, very small, of about 15. They should begin at the first light and then have another group, and each one should have a designated time to come and pray there, and the same is true for Mincha. We find Rabbi Akiva Eiger already identifying in a shul the idea of what we are calling today social distancing. Already in 1831, Rabbi Akiva Eiger was aware of the concept of social distancing and insisted that in the town of Posen, people find different ways of being able to find themselves in small groups so that cholera should not spread from one person to the next. And then he continues and he says, after each and every davening, both evening and morning, people should recite Tehillim. And those sections should be followed by some of the texts of Kel Rachum Shemecha, Aneinu Hashem Aneinu, Misha Anani, Ratzon after Tehillim. This is not a surprise. That's what we do after we recite Slichos. Indeed, the chief rabbi, the Rishon Litzion, Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef Shalita, has suggested that Israel communities do the same thing, that they should also engage in extra Slichos in the modern time. Again, there is a precedent. The precedent is our leader, Rabbi Akiva Eiger. But then Rabbi Akiva Eiger adds another issue, which I haven't seen enough of here, and is maybe somewhat indicative of something we might continue to add into our own writings. Rabbi Akiva Eiger says, after we're saying the Tehillim, mentioning in it the king, may Hashem protect him, and his children, and the nobles, and all who live in his land, He says a person should go ahead and mention the king, the children, and the nobles. If you, it's like the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, have a mispalel b'shlomo shel malchus, that we have a responsibility to daven for the king and the government. Because if we don't, ishes re'el chayim below, each one of us, men and women, we'd be at each other's throats. It's a good thing that we have government. We should daven for the safety of the governmental leaders. And Rabosai, one of the great challenges that a cholera epidemic or a pandemic brings up for us, whether it's coronavirus or cholera, the first thing we need to see from Rabbi Akiva Eger is the mentioning and the recognition of the king or the president or the leadership, and not to be the first ones to go attack everything. Because once we start attacking Ishes Re'eu Chaim below, what happens is we're going to get destroyed and we are going to go after one another, and this is never a good thing. The second thing that he mentions in the letter is that each and every morning, the people have a responsibility to in the middle of Karbanos, to say the entire text of the Ketores, and afterwards to say the Ribon text that's presented in the Ma'amados for Sunday after the recitation of the Ketores. This is something that people should remember as well. The recitation of Pitama Ketores in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, it was very well understood that the recitation of Ketores, which was a gift on Ma'amad Har Sinai, when Moshe Rabbeinu went up to Shamayim to receive the Torah. So at that point in time, when the Torah was given, each one of the Malachim came along and gave Moshe Rabbeinu a gift. And the Malacham Avos gave him the gift of recognizing that Ketores can stop a Magefa. We don't have the ability to bring Ketores today, but Rabbi Akiva Eger tells us we could use the principle of Unishalma Parim Sifasenu, that our lips should stand in the place of the offering of the carbon itself. And bringing the Ketores is one of those opportunities. So perhaps taking the time out to recite the sections of the Ketores could be very useful for us and something that we might want to consider. Rabbi Kiebeger goes further, telling people that they have to be very careful not to exceed the quotas of the shuls, and that people have to give tzedakah, make sure that everybody has food. He warns the people to wear good clothing, to wear flannel, so that they shouldn't get sick, to not eat bad foods, to reduce eating fruit and fish and drinking alcohol. This sounds more like doctors talking than rabbis, but that's the point. The point over here is that the rabbis work hand in hand with the doctors. Rabbi Kiebeger orders us to be clean. Don't leave filth and dirt in the home. Clean clothing multiple times a day. Don't go in the walk around the city at night, so maybe sometimes between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. It's good to walk into the fields for air and to open the windows in the morning, but not to get sick. And a person had a responsibility to follow his instructions, so demanded Rabbi Akiva Eger the week before Rosh Hashanah. But this would have been fine and dandy, but it wasn't enough. Because a week later, there was going to be Rosh Hashanah. And what were people supposed to do then? And so in the second source in front of us, we find the Yamim Norayim Takanos that were instituted in the town of Posen. In the town of Posen for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, a new Takana for 1831 was put into place. In order for the shuls to be properly utilized on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, every seat would have normally been taken. And if we needed to create a situation of space distancing, which meant that we had to take out literally every other seat, people were going to fight with one another. Who gets to go to shul and who does not get to go to shul? So in the Takanos of 1831, which are found in a journal called Hamayan in volume 6, pages 9 to 12, we find a number of Takanos that Rabbi Akiva Eger put into place for the Yamim Noraim. And first and foremost, he demanded that every other seat be left empty. And so therefore, in order for that to be achieved, he decided that all the leaders would turn around and would conduct a lottery. And when the lottery would be conducted, people would either be assigned an even number or an odd number. At that point in time, the lottery would be conducted. And if you were in one group, you would be allowed to go to shul both days of Rosh Hashanah. If you're in the other group, you're allowed to go to shul for Yom Kippur, both at night and by day. That when you are not to be in shul, under the threat of the police, and Rabbi Akiva Eger asks that the police be employed to go ahead and keep the rules even. And he says, if anyone tries to break in, not in his right turn, the police should arrest him. So serious are the rules of social distancing in Posen. There were exceptions to the rules, and who was that? So in the next series of Takanos, we find that Rabbi Akiva Eger ruled that over here, that the leadership, the Balei Tefillah, the Baal Tekiah, the wives, it's interesting because he includes the wives of the Gaboim and the rabbis, and he says they are exempt from the lottery. I guess he wanted the Rebbetzins to be treated like the rabbis and to be able to enjoy the Tefillah both on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And by the way, he establishes in number 6 the rules for house minyanim. He says some people don't want to go to shul. They're going to make house minyanim. And he says in the town of Posen, this is unacceptable as well. And if you're going to make a house minyan, you have to make sure to have the necessary amount of space, just like you would have needed in shul. And if you can't do it, the house minyan should not take place. So these were ways that Rabbi Akiva Eger in 1831 already introduced the idea of social distancing, that serves as a model and a bit of a solace for those of us who are missing the opportunity to go to Minyan right now. Where we can keep the concept of social distancing, that's great. Where we can't, that's a problem, and so therefore it's better we not put ourselves at risk. In source number 9, we find that Rabbi Akiva Eger also shortened the davening significantly to prevent any spread of the cholera epidemic. He points out that the davening of Rosh Hashanah will not go more than 5 hours long. And he insists that the auction be canceled. And he insists that only one mishaberech be made for each person, and that the piyutim and the yotros be limited as well. It's interesting. Last Shabbos, I asked Rav Teitz the same question. Should we limit the yotros or perhaps eliminate them? And he told me this is in Posen in 1831. We were going to say the yotros. So I'm sorry to those of you here in Elizabeth, I tried, but this was the Takana of Rav Teitz. And not only that, in source 11, you see that Rabbi Akiva Eger insisted that if a person tries to come to shul on Rosh Hashanah without eating anything, he is breaking the rules. Everyone had to eat something warm, litom davar cham, before the person leaves his home. And once it's daytime, he has to have a cup of tea. Eating was required before davening in Posen. Make sure you preserved your strength. So you see a series of takanos to tell somebody he or she can't hear shofar and shul. That's a pretty serious takana. But for the sake of the health of the community, this was the need that Rabbi Akiva Eger had. It's interesting. I was talking to Mori Barabi Rav Shechter, who pointed out that the idea of davening tefillah b'tzibur is an important idea, but not at the risk of sakanas nefashos, and that a person's not allowed to put things on Hashem's shoulders, to tell Hashem, I'll do my thing and you'll do yours. And of course, in 1831, Rabbi Akiva Eger felt the same way. However, Rabbi Akiva Eger didn't exactly throw all mitzvos out the window. As you can see in source number 17, he points out, Hatzom b'yom ha-kippur mukhiyav min ha-Torah. He doesn't say that everyone can just not fast on Yom Kippur. He says that there's an obligation for people to fast on Yom Kippur. And so therefore, he says, what we're going to do is open up the municipal building of Posen, and we're going to have a rotation of doctors. And all the doctors who are there are going to rotate 2 doctors per shift to determine that if anybody has any questions as to whether he or she should be fasting at any point during the day, there will be doctors available to make that assessment. And everyone has a responsibility to follow the rules of the doctor. So we see some very serious takanos that are put into place, but we also see that halach is being kept at the same point in time. Now, the most important takana that came into place from Rabbi Akiva Eger was one that was going to cause him a certain degree of disagreement with his son-in-law. To get into this takana, which has a lasting effect in all Jewish communities today, almost all Jewish communities today, I am going to begin with a word of introduction. The Bir Halacha in the section on Mamar HaKadeshim describes who has the right to recite Kaddish first. Well, who has the order? What is the proper order for saying Kaddish first? Which is fascinating to us because we don't have people who say Kaddish first. What we have are people who look for the schus to go to the Amid first, but not to say Kaddish. And there, the Chafetz Chaim and the Bir Halacha explains that currently everybody says Kaddish together. And this is supported by the writings of Rabbi Yankala Emden, whose father, the Chacham Tzvi, kind of hints to us that the Emden Chacham Tzvi family had many, many Sephardic Minhagim. And he says, Rabbi Yankala Emden writes in his Siddur in Dinei Aleinu that the Sephardim have the right practice. And it is they who introduced the idea of having everybody who has a chiyuv recite the Kaddish first. The reason why it's good is because it gets rid of arguments and doesn't require us to have silly rules in our lives. But you should just know that Chasam Sofer felt that this was a problem. And he says that the major difficulty is that, on the one hand, the recitation of Kaddish is a davar shebekdusha. It's a holy issue that requires a full minyan. And we usually only have one chazan when we have that minyan. We also have to understand that different people say Kaddish at different speeds. And so therefore, all it creates is a lot of confusion. So where did the concept spread into the Ashkenazi community to leave the thought of the Chasam Sofer in Yoridea Simen Shemem Hei and return to the Sephardic practice? Folks, here's where history comes into play. And in Takana number 7, as identified in the old rule book of the Beis HaKnesses Hayashan of Posen, we read as follows. The Chodesh Av Shnas Tav Kuf Tzadi Aleph, in the year 1831, in the summer, the cholera epidemic began. There were a lot of people who were in Avelus and they wanted to say Kaddish. I instituted this rule to be Sephardic, to have everyone say the Kaddish together. That's the way it continued for a full year. When the month of Av came in the year 1832, where the cholera epidemic ended, I made a takana that people shouldn't say Kaddish together anymore, except for once a day, which was the Kaddish after Shacharis, but not all other Kaddishim. And so this way, no Avel should never have an opportunity to say Kaddish during his 11 months. This was the break from the tradition that is so strongly decried by Rabbi Kiva Eger's son-in-law. And even Rabbi Kiva Eger insists that he put it back into place, albeit with certain changes. This, too, is a remnant of the cholera epidemic of 1831. Unfortunately, it's not a remnant that a lot of people keep. The Chaye Adam in Klal Amid Zion points out that today everyone has Kaddish recited together. He recommends that people say the Kaddish all standing together as one. He recommends having at least two people answering you. But those who follow the Chazon Ish don't do that anymore. Those who follow the Chazon Ish make it their business to only have one person do it. Rav Sternbach and the Tzitz Eliezer of Waldenburg, they say no. They say what we should do is have all the people saying Kaddish stand in the same place so that they can all hear one another and not create the bilbul. I'd like to point out that continues to be the minhag even here in Elizabeth, and it should continue. Where did all of this come from in the Ashkenazi community? It came as a result of the cholera epidemic of 1831. How did things play out for Rabbi Kiva Eger with the close? We're almost out of time, so I'd like to make sure we get to this. Well, the guy we're watching, and in the biography Rabbi Akiva Eger Bechayav on page 88, the local authority wrote to Emperor Frederick Wilhelm III to tell him just how the cholera epidemic was managed in the city of Posen and how the rub of the city really, really helped avert the death. And so, as you can see in the next source, the emperor wrote an incredible proclamation dated the 5th of September, 1831, thanking Rabbi Kiva Eger. Legend has it that the proclamation came to Rabbi Akiva Eiger by messenger on Shabbos, and it came in with the emperor's seal from Frederick Wilhelm. Normally, that can only be broken by the recipient of the letter to make sure that it was delivered appropriately. Here it is, Shabbos. The royal messenger is standing there, and Rabbi Akiva Eiger can't open the seal on Shabbos. He doesn't know what to do. So legend has it, he just sat there and stared at the letter in the hand of the messenger till the messenger figured out that Rabbi Akiva Eiger would not open the letter, and then he opened it for him, thus averting a situation of Amir Lenachri and allowing Rabbi Akiva Eiger to have the proclamation read before him, as was done. They report that on the way out, the messenger turns and sees on Rabbi Akiva Eiger's table on the side that there's a bowl containing ripped up stamps of the emperor all over there. And so he asks the Rav, he turns to Rabbi Akiva Eiger and he says to him, "Hey, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, what's up with these ripped up stamps? Are you, God forbid, against the crown? You have something horrible going on in your life that you have against the emperor? What kind of nonsense is this?" And Rabbi Akiva Eiger turns to him and he says to him, "Oh no, you got it backwards. I want you to know something. A lot of people write letters to me, and very often I try very hard to get back to them as soon as possible. And when I try to get back to them as soon as possible, I sometimes look for somebody who happens to be traveling back to the city that the person who wrote me is heading to. And I'll often send it that way so people don't have to wait for the post. Unfortunately, when I do that, I realize I'm cheating the government out of money. So I go to the post office, buy the parallel amount of postage, and then turn around and present the postage and rip it in half so that I'm not cheating anybody within the process." And this totally blew away the messenger, who ran back to the emperor to tell him how incredible Rabbi Akiva Eiger was as a personality. For us, I think what we take away from Rabbi Akiva Eiger is an individual who went through a epidemic, a man who had all the right in the world to just say, "Ich bin a Rov, I'm a rabbi, and I only handle halachic issues." But Rabbi Akiva Eiger doesn't do that. Rabbi Akiva Eiger gets involved in the entire episode. He makes sure from soup to nuts that the people are able to live successfully. He davens for the king, and he encourages us to do so as well. Many lessons that we can take. And so therefore, as we are going through whatever we're going through, it's important for us to realize we're not going through it alone. We can take strength from those who walked before us, the strength in the Tehillim that they recited, and use it to intensify our own tefillos. The strength in the recitation of the Ketores, because the Ketores has the power to get rid of Magefa. To take the strength in who we are as well, and how we can reach out to one another to make sure our communities wind up strong, and not to put ourselves above the community at large. Rabbi Akiva Eiger winds up being an incredible personality for us to learn from. And Be'ezras Hashem, we're going to learn that even in the tough times, we're never alone. We have people in our past who continue to be guides for us as well. I thank you all very much. And tune in for the next session of Profiles in the Pandemic, when we're going to move to a famous episode that may or may not have happened, as we meet Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and the supposed Yom Kippur episode of 1848. Everyone have a wonderful night and a terrific Shabbos. Q&A tomorrow, a town hall meeting. Be well.